This is Jim Engster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with syndicated columnist Jules Whitcover. For 24 years, he wrote a column with Baton Rouge's Jack Durmond. His book is The American Vice Presidency, From Irrelevance to Power. Also, Attorney General Buddy Caldwell in a dispute with the state of Texas over disposal of ashes in Louisiana related to the belongings of a man who died from Ebola. We'll talk with the Attorney General of Louisiana. Also, we are slated to hear from Boyd Professor of English, Dr. Gerald Kennedy. He is providing the fall community lecture for the Literary Circle of LSU, Postwar Paris, and the Tangled Friendship of Hemingway and Fitzgerald. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside this area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Engster Show. Our leadoff guest for the week, and by the way, we have just 10 days remaining together on this station, and it's been quite a joy over the last decade and more, and we'll do our best over the next 2 weeks to keep the flame burning. Bob Mann did an excellent job as guest host last Friday, and we thank him for sitting in this chair. Jules Whitcover is our guest, American journalist, author, and columnist. For many years, he was partnered with Jack Durmond, the pride of Baton Rouge High. They wrote a five-day-a-week syndicated column for 24 years and wrote several books about the American presidency and presidential campaigns. Jules Whitcover's latest work is The American Vice Presidency, From Irrelevance to Power. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you, Jules. Before we get to the book, Jack Durmond, he left quite a void, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
He was a presence as a personality as much as he was a journalist, and he was a pretty darn good journalist.
Yes, he was.
You collaborated with him for many years writing about the presidency. I recall the last one, I think, was 1992, Mad as Hell, and that's been 22 years. And since that time, we've had some rather strong vice presidents, Albert Gore, Dick Cheney, Joe Biden. Who's the strongest vice president we've had?
Well, I would have to say it was Cheney, although he was very controversial. His views on expanding the presidency and dealing with detainees during the last couple of wars stirred up a lot of opposition. But he certainly was a strong vice president.
That may be an understatement. Is there anybody in his league as far as influence on what happened in the world during the 8 years that Richard Cheney was the number two person in the United States government?
Well, as I say in my book, the other very strong vice presidents have been Walter Mondale, who really was the first vice president to exert any significant role in the governance of the country, which he owed both to his president, Jimmy Carter, and actually to himself, because when he was approached about being vice president, he sent a memo to Jimmy Carter outlining what Carter would need for his vice presidency. He had no Washington experience, and what he, Mondale, could bring. After that example, most, but not all, presidents followed that routine, and to the benefit of the country as well as the presidency.
The book is The American Vice Presidency, From Irrelevance to Power. Jules Whitcover, the guest. You say that John Adams, our nation's first vice president, took office in the number two slot with George Washington, saying, "I'm in this. In this, I am nothing, but I may be everything." That pretty much summed it up.
Yes, it did sum it up at the time, and he really wasn't called upon very much by Washington to play any significant role. But it didn't matter all that much since they were agreeable on in agreement on policy. But the manner in which Adams was chosen, which was that he was the runner up in balloting for president under that procedure, soon turned out to be a disaster, because when an Adams became the second president, his runner-up was Thomas Jefferson. Adams was a Federalist, and Jefferson was the leader of the Anti-Federalists. So that created a situation in which they really didn't agree on policy, and Jefferson was very little used by Adams, in spite of his experience. And indeed, Jefferson used his vice presidency, his period as vice president, for 4 years under Adams, developing the rival party, which came to first be called the Republican Party, eventually the Democratic Republican Party, and what we call today the Democratic Party. So that procedure was changed by the 12th Amendment with the separation of the election of president and vice president. So since then, at least, we've had teams in the two jobs, which is, I think, mm-hmm. is beneficial.
Well, Jefferson certainly had a feisty vice president, and Aaron Burr. Those two didn't see eye to eye, did they?
Well, no, they didn't. Well, policy wasn't a matter of policy, though. It was a matter of competition. They both received the same amount of votes in the presidential election through a miscalculation, in which some delegates Jefferson were supposed to cast a vote for somebody other than Burr. It wound up in being a tie, and the election had to be settled in the Senate. On top of that, there was that little incident where Aaron Burr killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel, and served as vice president, even though he had been indicted for murder. So that was kind of messy, and that was the end of Aaron Burr's career.
That little incident in 1804 took a while, but a couple of hundred years later, we had a vice president shoot somebody again in Dick Cheney. But that was an accident. What about Nixon? How prominent was he as a vice president under Eisenhower?
Well, he was given a public role, a visible role, through his foreign travel, which Nixon made the most of. But he really wasn't all that influential in the Eisenhower administration. And in fact, when Nixon ran for president the first time in 1960, Eisenhower was asked at a press conference, which I happened to be at, if he could name one policy or idea that Nixon had made that he used. And Eisenhower, who wasn't the most political person in the world, replied, "I don't remember. If you give me a week, I may be able to think of one," which is a pretty damaging thing for him to say for the Nixon presidency. And Nixon never really got over that. Did lose the election to Kennedy.
A close one, and then, of course, he came back. And then we had Reagan and George H.W. Bush. George Bush ascended to the presidency, beating Michael Dukakis in 1988 after serving 8 years as vice president. And Reagan and Bush, as you recall in your 1988 book, they were bitter enemies for a while on the campaign trail in 1988, but Bush had almost an overnight epiphany. Maybe it was an overnight epiphany, and accepted just about everything Reagan offered.
Yeah, he criticized Reagan's economic policy as voodoo economics during the campaign. He denied later that he ever said it, but he was found on a tape to actually have said it. And I don't think Reagan really ever got over that. He didn't. He wasn't very pleased about picking Bush as his running mate, and In fact, there have been conversations President Ford, Gerald Ford, to take the job, and Ford, after much discussion back and forth, thought better of it, and Reagan thought better of it, and so that idea of what was then called a co-presidency was abandoned, and that's how Bush was kind of the next available choice.
Question from Terry at Southern University. What about Joe Biden? What kind of a vice president has he been?
I think he's been an excellent vice president in the same mode as Mondale. And that, by that I mean he was a general advisor. He wasn't given a particular area of concern and then moved off into that area, which in somewhat a way, Al Gore was a specialist on the environment and on reorganizing the government. Mondale and Biden have been general advisors who have complete access to the president, to his person, and to all meetings that the president has with foreign leaders, and certainly has had President Obama's ear on the whole matter of dealing with Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, in 2009, when the generals urged Obama to increase forces in Iraq, Biden was one of the chief persons urging him against that move. He was called by some the House skeptic, but Obama finally agreed to the force increase, but under the caveat that the troops eventually would be removed, which is what happened in 2011. So Biden was not decisive, but he certainly had an influence on Obama on that policy.
You've written a book about Joe Biden. You also wrote one about Spiro Agnew, a vice president who left in disgrace. What do you recall about Agnew?
Well, I recall him as being probably the worst person that I've ever covered in politics, and that would include the disgraced Richard Nixon because of Watergate. Agnew turned out to be literally a crook. He took bribes while he was a governor of Maryland from contractors to whom he had given lucrative state business, and even received payments from them thereafter while he was in the vice presidency, not for anything he did as vice president, but what he did in Maryland. So he clearly was the biggest mark on the vice presidency that there was.
You mentioned you were at Eisenhower's press conference in 1960 when he made the inflammatory remark about his vice president. Who's the best president you've covered?
Best president?
Yes, sir.
Well, I would say, except for the terrible exception of the Vietnam War, Lyndon Johnson, in terms of domestic affairs, was a masterful politician and a strong president. But of course, that was a big exception and a blemish on his whole record.
And the worst?
The worst. It's hard to say, but certainly Nixon's disgrace in Watergate, and I think the Watergate story still comes out details that there's a lot more than just the Watergate break-in that was which he violated the Constitution and the trust of the American people.
Jimmy Carter's not remembered as a great president. He's now regarded as a great humanitarian, but his 4 years were without a great deal of distinction, other than Camp David.
Well, I would say that his dealing with his vice president and elevating the stature of the vice presidency and the use of the vice presidency could have been his greatest contribution.
Walter Mondale. A forgotten man who carried only one state in 1984. And Jules Whitcover wrote about that race. Now he's writing about the 47 American vice presidents. And we'll return with him for a few more moments. 297-5633 is your number. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Jules Whitcover, his latest work, The American Vice Presidency, From Irrelevance to Power. And coming in just a few is Buddy Caldwell, the Attorney General of Louisiana. Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with Jules Whitcover. Hi, Randy. Good morning, Randy.
Thinking about Alvin Barkley, that was Harry Truman's vice president. That I've never heard any. I heard a lot of nice things about him. Thanks,
Alvin Barkley. What about him?
He was not influential in the Truman administration, but he made the most of it. He remarried at the age of something like 60, at a very charming older woman, and that increased Barkley's popularity. But he wasn't as significant, and it was surprising that Truman, after suddenly having become president with the death of FDR, would have picked such an old man to succeed him, since Truman had a perfect example of the importance of having an active vice president. When Truman became president, he was not aware of such a momentous event as the development of the atomic bomb, and he came into office not knowing it was going on, and so that was a huge decision dumped in his lap when he became president. And since then, it was recognized the importance of at least keeping vice presidents informed about what was going on in the administration in which they served.
Well, Jules Whitcover is one of the most prolific writers in American political history. His latest is The American Vice Presidency. His syndicated column runs in the Baton Rouge Advocate. How many presidents have you covered?
Well, everyone since Eisenhower. So... As Casey Stengel would say, you could look it up.
I think that's 11. 11 out of 44, so 25% of the presidents. And, of course, actually it's 11 out of 43 since Grover Cleveland was president twice. More than a quarter of the presidents have come under the scrutiny of this fine journalist, and we hope you keep going for many more years. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. 297-5633, and we're joined now by James David Buddy Caldwell, the Attorney General of the great state of Louisiana. Last week, a judge, Bob Downing, granted Buddy Caldwell his request for a temporary restraining order to keep Ebola waste ashes out of Louisiana. What's going on?
Well, we are going to have another hearing. We believe we have an agreement between the parties to keep the waste out while we're developing proper protocol, because one of the problems that we would have would be what happens if Louisiana has Ebola, and what is our protocol. So we're working as we speak this morning and tomorrow to see if our parties will agree to continue the restraining order until we can work out the details.
Why did you seek the restraining order, General?
Well, when we found out that the proper protocol, we were not even called from the Texas facilities. They just said they're delivering the ash into Louisiana. And there are protocols, so our officials didn't even know that the ash was coming in. There's a report that you have for the chemical waste people were out of Lake Charles. It's called a characteristic of ash report. And they were not even informed. So we found out in the newspapers by the media reports, the same way our State Department's found out that there was delivery coming into Louisiana. And it's not whether the waste can be incinerated. And It's whether there was proper treatment. If we have our Louisiana people on the ground in the facilities, we would have had all the information and all the reports. But this was for another state. And for another state to send their ashes here without affidavits, certificates, and permits, which are required for the proper disposal of this hazardous medical waste, whether it's Ebola or any other waste, you have to follow the protocol. So we would be idiots to accept this without the protocol.
Okay. Louisiana Attorney General Buddy Caldwell, his distinctive voice is the one we're hearing. He says sought the restraining order, which he received, to stop the incinerated belongings of Dallas Ebola victim Thomas Eric Duncan, who became the first patient diagnosed with the U.S. with Ebola and died from the disease. The items include linens, carpets, bedding from Duncan's apartment. Six truckloads of the potential Ebola-contaminated material were burned at a facility in Port Arthur, Texas, not far from Louisiana. And how in the world was Louisiana chosen as the final resting place for the ashes?
Well, that was an internal decision by the company Veolia, who transports the waste, and they transported 142 55-gallon drums from Dallas to the incinerator. And we don't know whether the incineration was done properly. Was it mixed with other contaminants? And what essentially has happened here is Texas has asked us to take their word for it, and the CDC. Take our word for it that this was all done right. Trust me, in other words. And I'm a prosecutor. I'm going to not trust anybody unless I have hard evidence of it, and it's as simple as that. Our public health officials were not informed. We had no certificates, no affidavits, no permits. And so, again, we don't question the fact that if you incinerate something between 18 and 2100 degrees, that it will kill it. But we have to have the assurances and hard evidence that that was done, and that they just were sneaking it into Louisiana and hoping that nobody would question it.
So was the government in the great state of Texas also complicit in this?
Yes, they were. We got no calls from any government agency, the Department of Transportation, at Texas DHH, or the Texas Department of Environmental Quality. None of those people called or informed any Louisiana folks. Again, if we had had this treated in a Louisiana hospital, we would have had our own people on the site. We would have had the affidavits, the certificates, and we would have had to dispose of hazardous waste ourselves. But we could not control what Texas gives us or what the CDC said was proper. And they're supposed to have tested the incineration. What's the difference in that? Why didn't they inform us of what those tests were? And if we have a Louisiana state contingency plan, we would have to have what hospitals treats the patients, where the medical waste goes to be treated, and where the medical waste goes for disposal. These are the issues that we have to deal with, and these are real issues. This is not a scare tactic or any of those kind of things. This is following the law for disposal of hazardous waste, and this is a very, very serious issue, one that you can't say, just trust me. We absolutely have empirical data that the government agencies could not be trusted out of Texas and the CDC. They didn't give us anything to trust.
Mm-hmm. So the precedent, I guess, is something that would be dangerous. After all, we do have nuclear plants in each of the states and oil refineries. So if you accepted the ashes, are you saying you'd have to accept something worse than that if the time came?
Well, state regulations of each state, and Louisiana has good regulations that if you do what you're supposed to, the waste may not be hazardous. And in Texas, they have nuclear waste disposal. They have similar statutes to what we have. And if you treat the waste right, for example, they've got to put certain linings in these hazardous waste disposals. You got to dispose of it in concrete. And they have huge waste facilities in within the state of Texas. And as long as it's done properly, there is no reason to be afraid of it. But we've all seen that we can't trust these officials to get it right and even certify it.
297-5633 for the always loquacious and outspoken Buddy Caldwell, Attorney General for Louisiana, and he has won round one on this. So where does it go from here?
Well, we're having a hearing is set for Wednesday in court, but what we're trying to do is we have a pretty good agreement with the an understanding, that is, with the parties. The chemical waste people out of Lake Charles, they were not informed of the characteristic of the ash that was coming in the facility. So they, what we want to do is get the ash disposed of properly. And the other parties, the Veolia parties, we're asking them to agree to extend this temporary restraining order for a couple of weeks, let's say, until we can see if we can work out all the details so that we have a safe, disposal can of hazardous medical waste can be done properly. And the another thing that has happened since this has begun is whether or not Louisiana develops its own protocol. For God's sakes, you know, we are probably going to have Ebola patients, and so we need to know what medical facilities within our state would treat the patients, would handle the waste, and how the waste gets transported and disposed of safely. So Louisiana has to develop its own plan as well, and these are very important public health and safety issues, and we at the Attorney General's office have got plenty to do, and what we try to do is if an issue comes up to deal with it by virtue of no BS and hard evidence, and that's my procedure of dealing with issues, because we got plenty to do.
Lisa in Clinton. Lisa, you're on with General Caldwell.
Hi, this is Lisa.
We know that.
Okay, Lisa.
Okay, I didn't
Buddy
hear
Caldwell.
The first part of your call. Okay, I'm not concerned about this waste, these ashes, and I'm wondering what the concern is. My background is in biology and medical research, and viruses do not generally survive. I don't know of any virus that can survive cremation.
Well, and you're right. And we agree with you there. It's whether or not the incineration has been certified to have taken place. Who can tell us whether half of it was incinerated, all of it was incinerated, whether the containers that brought the incineration in were properly handled. So it's not whether or not scientifically if the viruses can be killed. Certainly that's true. But we have to follow protocol and the assurance. And in this case in particular, we were asked to take the word of the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and the Texas officials that it had been properly incinerated. And they didn't even give the source of where the ash was coming from Port Arthur to our people in Lake Charles. So why should we take anybody's word? Yes, if you dispose of it properly, it's going to be safe. But we have in our regulations a need for affidavits, certificates, permits for disposing of it, and there are only a certain number of people who can dispose of hazardous medical waste. And there's a reason for that, is because it has to be handled very carefully and very properly because of the gravity of the harm. People die. Infectious diseases are spread exponentially, and we're seeing that. So we just want to be careful and caution, err on the side of caution.
Have you gotten a lot of calls about this?
Yes. Oh, my God. The phone's been ringing off the hook, and we're only in one week of the information about the disposal. And it's nothing to panic about. We know we can eliminate the virus, but it is, you have to be careful about whether you propagate or fear is real. What is perceived is real, and if people are scared of it, that is a real thing that you have to deal with. So we're going to get it straight with a limited number of people, the limited number of hospitals that can handle it safely, get to protocol where you don't have everybody on the street. Some with wearing these moon suits that have holes in them, or with skin exposed, you have people in moon suits, and then you have somebody who's standing there in street clothes with a face mask on. Duh. So you have to have people follow serious protocol for serious issues, and this is of the utmost importance for us to get this one right.
All right, 297-5633. Boyd, Professor of English, Jerry Kennedy will be with us shortly, but we have a few more minutes with Buddy Caldwell, and we will take a break. But before we hit the break, election, state election, a year and 4 days away. Are you running for re-election?
Yes, I am. I'm since I've been in this for 6.5 years, I've learned how important it is for this office to get it right. And the Attorney General's offices are not political. It's not about party. It's about issues and taking care of the legal business of the state. And it's a lot involved. And the experience that I have is very, very important. That's why.
All right, we'll be back with James, David, Buddy Caldwell in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Buddy Caldwell, Jim at LSU. Hi, Jim. You're on with General Caldwell.
Yes, my question is, doesn't Texas have landfills? I'm going to hang up and listen.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
what
he says.
Doesn't Texas have landfills?
Oh, my God, yes. Texas has got landfills for disposing of nuclear waste, et cetera. And when we're asked about the issue, whether it's Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama, we all need to have the security that we're having a safe disposal. We can incinerate it. We can use autoclave and pressure and steam to get rid of a lot of the dangerous medical waste. But what we want to be able to do is get a handful of spots where everybody can feel secure that it's being safely and properly disposed of, including the transportation. It's not just where you dump the ash. It's how you get it there and whether it's tested, whether there are contaminants still on the containers, There are a lot of issues. It's very complicated. And there, we need to have a plan in each state. How is each state going to deal with it? Because that's the real issue.
Cass on Highland. Cass, you're on with Buddy Caldwell.
Hi. So we know that the disease can't survive incineration. My question is there cases or is there records of things supposed to be incinerated that weren't incinerated right? Like,
that's part of the state regulations in each state, including Texas. Louisiana has regulations, and if the waste is disposed of, if it's incinerated properly, then it's you can put it in a regular landfill. But because of the gravity of the harm, that means you can die, or you can have one of these bubonic plague type of situations where everybody gets a disease and you can have the people die from it. That's called the gravity of the harm. And when you can die, you want to make sure that you tend to the business. And there are contaminants, and the people had on the moon suits, and they got the disease. And people were careless, and they weren't told how to do it, whether their skin was exposed. So we don't know the answer to all those questions, and we should take the time in the next few weeks to develop a serious protocol, and an urgency to this is the reason for us filing a temporary restraining order. It was the only remedy we had was to go to court to keep it contained, and then take the time we need to work out the details.
Okay. Another question from a listener general about the decision by Judge Clark here in Baton Rouge, saying that the oil and gas lawsuit shall go forward despite legislation that the House and Senate passed last session. Your thoughts?
Well, we had contended that we were correct in doing what we did, which was to reflect on a resolution that the oil and gas people could file the suit. We didn't know about the merits of it. It's just whether it was reasonable to do it. And when you put people on the table, I mean, if you mess up, you clean up. There are issues legitimately on both sides. The oil and gas industry has legitimate issues, and the folks that were contaminated, they have issues. And what you do is you try to reach a compromise with that. If there weren't a problem, it wouldn't be litigated. And we look for resolutions in Louisiana, and I think there is a mutual ground for both folks to get to the table and have a potential settlement. Nobody's going to settle anything unless you get sued and have exposure. Our oil and gas companies are independent contractors. They contracted to take the oil and gas and to clean it up afterwards. And so there's reason on both sides for potential agreement. And I think that's the best solution, is for there to be a compromise, which to me, a good compromise is something that neither side is totally happy with, but each one gets what they have come for, and our waters need to be cleaned up. And we represent at the state of Louisiana, we have 5 million acres of potential waste and cleanup that's done, and the largest landowner in the state of Louisiana is the state of Louisiana, who we represent. We would like to see this cleaned up, and then let's start all over. Let's help our oil and gas industry, and let's help do the cleanup. Let's just do it right.
General, we thank you for joining us today. It's always nice to talk with you.
Okay, Jim, it's my pleasure.
Take care. See you soon.
Thank you.
And joining us in studio is Boyd Professor of English, Dr. Gerald Kennedy. He's been at Louisiana State University now more than 40 years. 1973, wasn't it?
That's correct.
You were quite a young man then.
I was, yeah.
Right out of Duke University.
That's right.
Which produced Richard Milhouse Nixon.
I heard your earlier interview, yeah.
Yeah. So. But you will be talking about literary figures rather than political ones this week, Thursday night at 7 o'clock. Dr. Kennedy will give the fall community lecture for the Literary Circle of LSU, and the title of the talk is Postwar Paris and the Tangled Friendship of Hemingway and Fitzgerald. That was one for the ages.
That was. That was a really interesting relationship, and what I've tried to do is to put together a story. This is not an academic performance. I'm really trying to make this an interesting, compelling story for everyone who attends to understand who these writers were, how their lives got mixed up together in Paris in 1925, and how they influenced each other, and in some ways how they reacted against each other later in life.
Almost 90 years ago.
That's right.
Yeah, Woody Allen had a movie about that a few years ago. Did you see that?
He did. In fact, I'm beginning with a couple of clips from Midnight in Paris, some famous scenes where Fitzgerald and Hemingway show up. Yeah,
they were different types of people.
They were absolutely different, yeah. But I think in some ways they were similar. They were both Midwesterners. They were born about the same time. They both were involved in the action, at least the preparation for World War I. Hemingway went to the front lines and served in the Red Cross Ambulance Corps in Italy, where he was wounded. Fitzgerald, somewhat to his chagrin, was still in training in Alabama and never made it across the water for the big fight.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hemingway prided himself on these macho exploits, World War I, World War II,
right.
Bullfighting, boxing,
right.
Hunting, and then he killed himself. Now, Fitzgerald, he's known for one great work, among others, but if you were to ask a book by Scott Fitzgerald, we'd get probably one answer on most occasions. Not the same with Hemingway. Was Hemingway the greater writer?
I think in the long run, Hemingway was. I mean, one measure of that, a crude measure, is that Hemingway won the Nobel Prize and Fitzgerald never did. But it's also true that Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby shows up at or very near the top of the list for the most influential books of the 20th century. Hemingway wrote some great novels. A Farewell to Arms certainly ranks very high in that list as well. And I think it's his overall career achievement that probably represents the difference in accomplishment between the two.
For years, we would have television anchors who wanted to sound like Walter Cronkite or David Brinkley, and they were emulated in local markets almost laughably in some cases.
Right.
But Hemingway had a style that many have tried
to
emulate, but has anyone come close?
I think so. I mean, one of my favorite late 20th century authors, Raymond Carver, wrote some really brilliant short stories. And I think for a good while he was sort of pushing for the Hemingway minimalist approach with a lot of innuendo between the lines. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Post-war Paris, that was an exotic place and this convergence of two great minds, two great writers. It had some magic to it.
It really did. I mean, I think the popularity of Midnight in Paris is not an accident. A lot of people are absolutely spellbound by the idea of Paris in the 20s. Hemingway and Fitzgerald were there. I would say Paris had a much bigger impact on Hemingway's career than on Fitzgerald's. Fitzgerald arrived in Paris after he'd finished The Great Gatsby, and frankly, his French was so poor that he had very little interest in sort of merging himself in the culture, whereas Hemingway really learned the language pretty well in a kind of slangy way, went to the bicycle races, went to the boxing matches, read the sporting newspapers in French, went to the racetrack. He really kind of immersed himself in the sort of the working class world of Paris mm-hmm. on the left bank.
Did they live nearby?
No, that's an interesting difference. When Fitzgerald came to Paris in 1925, Hemingway was living in a tiny little apartment over a sawmill. The noise was so horrible, he had to go to the Closerie des Lilas to write because it was just annoying, whereas Fitzgerald was making a ton of money, and he had a very large apartment by the Arc de Triomphe off mm-hmm. the Champs-Élysées. So their neighborhoods were not the
same. How did they end up in that place at the same time?
Well, I think like many, many people who had literary, artistic interests, they were drawn to France after World War II, in part because of the exchange rates. These are things I'm going to talk about on Thursday night at 7, but the exchange rates were incredibly attractive at that time. Number two, there was no prohibition in France. And for thirsty fellows like Hemingway mm-hmm. and Fitzgerald, that was a great attraction as well. And then there was the great freedom to be whoever you wanted to be in Paris. There was a great sense of excitement, energy. Mm-hmm. Artistic innovation was everywhere around them. And I think, you know, regardless of whether they were plugged into the culture or not, everyone felt that energy, that desire to do the new thing, to mm-hmm. be that writer, that painter who shocks everyone.
What was a night like on the town with say, Hemingway at that time?
Well, they were both pretty formidable drinkers, although I'd have to say Fitzgerald was probably in a league of his own. He had a lot more money than Hemingway did, and so he would very often start at the Ritz Bar, and sometimes he would meet Hemingway on the left bank, and they would drink at the Select. But there's a story I'm going to tell about Fitzgerald waking up the Hemingways at 5 o'clock in the morning, just totally drunk one day. That's sort of characteristic of Fitzgerald. He was mm-hmm. he was quite a case.
Did Hemingway like to fight?
Hemingway loved to fight. He boxed with anyone who would put on gloves against him. In fact, one of the things that I discovered with great interest when I was helping to edit the Hemingway letters, the new Cambridge edition, in 1925, Hemingway started giving Fitzgerald boxing lessons in Paris. I mean, that's something nobody knew before. He got in the ring with Ezra Pound, and in a famous moment, he got in the ring with a Canadian writer named Morley Callahan, and he got decked. I'm going to talk about that Thursday night, too.
And with a guy of his sense of self,
yeah,
to get decked must have been
It was
horrible.
It was a complete humiliation. You know, Hemingway was furious, and he got even angrier when the story showed up in a New York newspaper. He just went postal.
HB in Denham Springs, you're on with Dr. Gerald Kennedy. Hi, HB.
Good morning. Doctor, one of my English professors at LSU many years ago once commented that the English language, whether written or spoken, is the most difficult to understand of all known languages in the world because so many of our words have different meanings on how they're used in a sentence or a paragraph.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think probably the linguists would be better equipped, but I think it's true that the lexicon in English, the number of words in our dictionary, is one of the largest in the world. And you're right, there are many words that have multiple meanings. The fact that English is being spoken around the world, though, makes me think that there's something about English that makes it a language people can pick up more readily, say, than French, which I still think, and I've been speaking and working in French for many, many years, is still a very difficult language to hear if you don't live in that culture.
And you have gone to France many times.
I've spent many, many years in France. I'm going again next summer with the LSU in Paris program, and I'm teaching my Lost Generation course.
You have, like, favorite restaurants in Paris?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah? Can you name one?
Well, you know, there are a bunch of places that my wife and I like to go to on a regular basis. There's a... La Coupole is a nice restaurant to go to on the Boulevard Montparnasse. It was a famous cafe in the 1920s, and they still serve elegant meals there. They serve a very elegant breakfast there that I recommend.
Well, Dr. Jerry Kennedy, he's been at LSU now for over 40 years, and it's Thursday night at the new Digital Center, 7 o'clock. The talk, post-war Paris, and the tangled friendship of Hemingway and Fitzgerald. Two giants converging in the eyes and words of J. Gerald Kennedy, Boyd Professor of English. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Don't be a stranger.
Thank you.
We shall return tomorrow. Don Cashew will be one of our guests, by the way, the congressman who lost his seat to Bill Cassidy in 2008. Until tomorrow, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.